The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, research shows that college students are increasingly lonely. We'll dive into a study that examines students' mental health and how colleges and universities are fostering community and belonging. And the use of artificial intelligence in writing scientific research has skyrocketed. But does it create accuracy concerns? I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. The transition from high school to college, where students are away from their families and friends, can be a lonely time. And research shows that students are increasingly experiencing loneliness on campus. Overcoming Student Loneliness, a new report by the Chronicle of Higher Education, includes insight from dozens of students, administrators, scholars, and more to better understand how colleges can create a welcoming campus and foster community. To learn more, I spoke with Chronicle senior editor Alex Kafka.
It's a hard thing to get a quantitative gauge on, but there are studies out there and have been for years. And the general level of loneliness, according to, you know, some stats, has been going up literally for decades. And if you look at the research on the effects of social media and smartphones and the pandemic and some parenting practices, all of those have contributed. But college age students, the sort of younger Gen Z cohorts especially, show loneliness stats above 50%. According to at least one study from 2023, and even other studies show it in the 40s. And the numbers are pretty sobering.
So you mentioned a couple of factors in there, COVID-19, social media. Let's take the COVID pandemic. When you're looking at the numbers, did COVID, with all of its isolation that so many people experienced, did that really kick those feelings of loneliness into high gear, or was this number already trending upwards to begin with?
Both. So the numbers were trending up, and the experts I've talked to, I spoke to more than 50 people for the loneliness report, including clinicians and scholars and students and others. And most of them described the pandemic as exacerbating trends that had been noted since at least around 2011 or so, and then some of the broader trends going back even decades before that.
It's also, I think, worth pointing out that students who are, even students who are just graduating college right now in 2024, they were graduating high school in 2020. So every student that's going to be entering college right now for the next few years is going to have some experience probably of staying home during the pandemic. What can you tell me about the effects that COVID actually had on students who were impacted at a younger age?
Right. So the experts point out that, you know, while the class that's graduating around now, class of 2024, were hit in a particularly sort of brutal way by the lockdown period, that students who were younger and in other transitional periods, say, going from middle to high school, are also showing some pretty profound social and learning effects from that period. And if you read the report, you know, I cite a study that talks about learning lags that in some cases are pretty much a lost year. It depends a lot on the school system, the region, but in some places, That learning loss was particularly bad. And so you say, okay, what does that have to do with the social lags? But it does, because students who feel behind in learning often show some social difficulties and vice versa. And it can be sort of a downward spiral if you don't have, good pedagogy, a good school system with decent resources to try to pick up some of that slack. And so all that's to say that while colleges have seen, a snoot full of problems the last few years, it's not over. And the other thing, Lucas, that I heard a lot about during that lockdown period from psychologists who had studied things like the Spanish flu epidemic in World War I and sort of post-traumatic population-wide effects that followed some of those traumatic periods. And they were speculating that we might see what they were calling an echo pandemic of psychological and social disruption, unrest after, the sort of worst medical consequences of the pandemic were over. And some of the folks I spoke to think that we are in that e echo pandemic, that when you look at the startling rates of anxiety and depression among college students in the, 30s and 40s on percentages, when you look at suicidal ideation rates of, say, 13 or 14%, when you look at the loneliness figures, part of what the Surgeon General's called the loneliness epidemic, when you add all that up, they say, hey, maybe this is the echo pandemic. And while they would rather have been wrong about that, they might have been right.
Now, let's go back to social media. There's a lot of discussion right now at the state level and at the federal level of banning TikTok, for one, or restricting social media for young people. When politicians point to this, what are they actually referencing? What about social media is having such a negative impact on young people?
Yeah, so that's a fascinating and controversial topic. And a lot of folks I spoke to credited Jean Twenge, I hope I'm pronouncing her last name correctly, a psychologist in California who was writing about these issues way back in, 2016 or so, in her book, in an Atlantic Monthly article and elsewhere about some really dire statistics she was seeing that correlated with the smartphone and social media becoming adopted by more than half the population. I think that was a turning point right around 2011 or so. And Jonathan Haidt and his new book is sort of picking up on that in a more kind of advocacy tone, suggesting, hey, schools need to get students to put away those phones. And that's where some of this legislation in Florida and elsewhere that you're referring to is coming up, saying, hey, social media just shouldn't be allowed for, the bills differ, but say students 13 and under shouldn't have access to these or things along those lines. So, yeah, there's that. There are also skeptics, like George Will wrote a pretty acerbic column saying, hey, look, there's always been hysteria around two new technologies, even going back to the automobile that, people were afraid that it was going to lead to more, people having sex in the back seat, and that TV was going to ruin people's minds, and that the transistor radio or whatever, that whenever new technology comes along, people tend to freak out, and that's just kind of the nature of our culture. And so skeptics like Will are saying, hey, look, government intervention is not the answer here, even if it could work. And then there's a whole question of, gosh, can you really rely on state legislatures and politicians to come up with effective enough technologies that teens can't get around them? So that, there's a different level of skepticism there.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Alex Kafka, a senior editor at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Alex, what can you tell me about, since we're talking about social media apps, what can you tell me about mental health apps? These are something that I recall exploding during the pandemic. And is there any evidence that they're actually being used or that they could have an impact in helping young people who are dealing with loneliness?
Yeah, so that's a great set of questions. And the jury's still out on a lot of them. So what's clear is that a lot of colleges that were, just exploring mental health apps for students in a tentative way starting around 2017 or so, really exponentially expanded those efforts during COVID, just out of need and desperation. And then post-pandemic, that trend has continued. So something like 700 colleges are offering their students some kind of mental health apps. In some cases, more than one or different apps will be bundled together. Now, how much students are actually using them is a much different question. So, according to one study, about 53% of students downloaded a digital mental health app, but only 19% were currently using it, one of those apps. And so, a recent study that was sponsored by the Ruderman Family Foundation in conjunction with the Healthy Minds study, Boston University, UCLA, Irvine, was looking kind of skeptically at the amount of evidence that these apps work. So it's not so much that they were saying, hey, these apps don't do anything, colleges shouldn't buy them. They're actually saying, hey, these apps show considerable promise. So when you look at one study, say from 2019, these apps really seem to do at least some things pretty well. But the problem is they're expensive. Colleges, might spend in the hundreds of thousands of dollars for these things. And it's not always clear what they're getting for them. It's not clear how many students are using them. It's not clear if they do use them, if they stick with them. It's not clear how effective they are. And so, this group of researchers was basically saying, hey, we need a little more transparency, a little more data, a little more quantitative proof that these apps are working.
Now, I'm sure some college administrators might say to themselves, well, even if not everyone is using this mental health app that the college is paying these subscription fees for, at least some people are, right? I mean, there could be a small impact from cluing more people in, more young people into apps and programs that are designed to help them deal with the stresses of college and the stresses of everyday life.
Right. I think that is what's happening. Because if you look at surveys of college presidents during COVID, and I don't think this has changed. If anything, it's increased since then. Really, for many of them, their chief concern, and keep in mind, college presidents have a lot of concerns, enrollment concerns and tuition and all kinds of stuff. But their chief concern is students' mental health and particularly suicide prevention. And so for them, they might say, okay, yeah, these apps are not cheap, but we really have to throw anything and everything we have in the way of tools at this problem because it's that severe. And there are a lot of advantages of having some kinds of digital tools that complement college's counseling service. Some of them are, obvious or just convenience factors. The apps are 24/7. They can get beyond some of the state licensing issues that come up if, say, you're a student at a school in New York, but you're from where I am in Maryland, and my therapist here doesn't have a New York license. The apps can connect you with someone who you can keep working with on vacations, or if you speak another language, if you're an international student or you're study abroad or something like that. And they also address some cultural diversity accessibility questions, so that if a student is LGBTQ plus or from a particular ethnic or racial underrepresented group and wants to work with a therapist who they feel is more in sync with them, they have a wider array of choices with some of these digital apps. So those are just, some of the pluses. And I think college leaders are well aware of those and thinking, this isn't going to replace the counseling center, but it might really complement it in a good way.
I also want to point out when it comes to social media, young people are not afraid about talking about mental illness or talking about, if they're having a bad day. Is that also a trend that you've seen in your research?
It is. And it's cited widely as a silver lining to the pandemic. There aren't too many silver linings to the pandemic, but that's one, is that discussion of mental health concerns has really been destigmatized. And that's something that's kind of universally applauded. Now, the asterisk next to that is that there's been so much discussion of mental health that some experts are concerned that students are self-diagnosing everyday stress and everyday problems as medical problems when they aren't necessarily, and trying to, treat the counseling center as sort of the solution to all things that cause stress and aggravation in their world. And that is just more than any counseling center can bear. That's too much responsibility. So that's the asterisk next to it. But overall, yeah, the stigmas come way down. I do sometimes hear that, among certain cultures and groups, that there's still more stigma attached than you might think. So it's not that that problem's gone away, but I think it's a lot better. And sure, all over social media, you see peer support and just some authenticity about mental health concerns that you wouldn't have seen maybe 10, 20 years ago.
So let's focus on what colleges and universities are doing to help a student body that where more people are experiencing mental illness or are experiencing loneliness. What are colleges doing to meet the demands of students that have gone through a lot, including the pandemic?
Sure. Well, that's sort of the beauty of reporting on this topic is there's so many things we report on where colleges are kind of throwing up their hands and don't have too many solutions readily at hand. But when it comes to student loneliness, there are things colleges can do, and they're doing them. And while some of them require more money, more resources, whatever, some of them really don't. They just require a sort of a change in the culture and the conversation on campus. And so, part of it is just, gosh, bringing back obvious fun away from phones. Getting stuff going on campus, whether it's activities or street fairs or outdoor movie night, or I was talking to some folks at the School of Mines in Colorado, which is basically an engineering school, and it's sort of a work hard, play hard atmosphere, but where they have e-days, engineering days, and events like the cardboard boat race and things like that that just get students out of their rooms. When you talk to student affairs people and counseling center directors, they say there's nothing more that puts students more in mental health jeopardy than isolation in their rooms. At Bryant University in Rhode Island, I love this example because it's just so simple and brilliant. They give every student a lawn chair, and every new first year student, and that first night, that first week, they have all these outdoor activities and they just get people out of their rooms. The idea being there's no excuse to be isolating yourself at your desk the first week when there's all this cool stuff going on. And they mix it up with, learning events about the counseling center and activities and clubs and whatever, but they also just have fun stuff. So those are just some examples. An interesting thread to this is that there are a lot more students on campus with neurodiverse situations. They might be on the spectrum. They might have other social anxiety issues going on, where sort of quieter events, craft activities, things like that, are kind of more to their liking. And just sort of getting them in the room with, say, door prizes for people who come in first, and like maybe some kind of a raffle or something that will be announced at the end to get them to stay. Just, ways to get students together out of isolation, even in real quiet social situations. And then the third thing, and then I'll shut up on this, but it's really fascinating to me that, sometimes colleges don't realize that one of their greatest strengths is kind of hiding in plain sight, which is that they are places of learning. And just clubs and activities that deal with big questions of the universe, big problems of society, can really engage students in a wonderful way. And there's some examples in the report of that, of summer bridge programs, of a disability technology club at MIT, and some other things where, students can really connect over some thorny intellectual problems that they want to attack together and really enjoy going at.
And Alex, where is your research going to take you next? What do you want to explore after digging into this topic of student loneliness and how colleges and universities are helping students overcome feelings of loneliness?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, the same research group that was pointing out sort of the lack of public evidence, anyway, of some of the mental health apps, they're going to continue to look at that and urge both colleges and the vendors of these services to get more information out there. But they're also going to start exploring some of the peer support, peer education programs, not just for students, but for faculty and staff as well. There are a lot of programs, the Red Folder program, Mental Health First Aid, all kinds of things that seem to be helping, seem to be good ideas, but they want to get a better feel for what's actually working and why.
Alex Kafka is a senior editor at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Alex, thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Lucas. Thanks for your interest.
You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. The use of AI in writing scientific research has rocketed by 50% in the past year, according to a study of 15,000 academic papers. But what does this mean for the accuracy of the research? The BBC's Richard Hamilton has been investigating.
About 18 months ago, the tech company OpenAI unleashed its chatbot, ChatGPT. within a couple of months, 100 million users were regularly using this tool, making it the fastest growing consumer app in history. This same phenomenon is being seen in scientific research papers. Dr. Frederick Howard, who's assistant professor of medicine at the University of Chicago, looked at the prevalence of artificial intelligence in cancer research. By using AI content detectors, he found that it had doubled in 2023. He says this new technology has clear advantages, but comes with inherent dangers.
These tools can really speed up the writing process, and so that can be definitely a benefit, and it can help with maybe the wording of sentences, you know, when you're trying to draft something and you just can't get the right phrase. But these tools definitely have their limitations too. In particular, it's been well shown that the text that's generated by these models can sometimes contain things that are completely fabricated. Kind of a very clear example is oftentimes if you ask to describe a scientific study, it will give a citation to a study that just doesn't exist, and you know it's very demonstrably fake. The problem is if researchers are using this tool and not adequately reviewing the output of these types of large language models, then you might end up with things that are being perpetuated in the literature that are just untrue.
Dr. Howard says AI is a very powerful tool, but it has to be used responsibly, and stresses the need for proper safeguards to root out factual inaccuracies in research papers.
There was this one case where a published article started the introduction with the sentence was, "Sure, I can help you with that introduction." So it was something that was kind of obviously written by one of these chatbots. Aside from cases like that, it's going to be pretty difficult to prove with 100% certainty that something was written with one of these tools. Maybe it will just require editors to make sure that they're doing due diligence and the peer reviewers are doing due diligence to ensure the factual accuracy of content.
Despite the rapid rise in the use of artificial intelligence, a survey last week of 12,000 people across 6 countries suggested most adults had only tried tools like ChatGPT once or twice, and there was less enthusiasm amongst older people. Yet even with this generational divide, artificial intelligence is here to stay, and it may be that we just need to control it better.
The BBC's Richard Hamilton reporting. If you'd like to tell the best of our knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the best of our knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit WAMCpodcasts.org. This has been the Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1760. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Jody Cowan. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, WAMC.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.